Alrighty, time for Truth About Markets, New Zealand, on RDU, Christchurch, New Zealand. Stacey.
Oh boy, I really wish I were actually here in Christchurch instead of here, the other here in Paris, because you're going into your summer, which is really nice. We're getting cold here.
Oh, it's so cold. Brr. Well, let's see what happened in the last week. Oh, yeah, you had the whole interesting dichotomy kind of surface in a big way. People are seeing the two ends of the spectrum. You've got banks like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan reporting record bonuses. At the same time, you've got record foreclosures in the United States, people losing their home. And just for the listeners out there in Christchurch, let's review quickly the accounting fraud that is the basis of the bonuses. The housing market is still collapsing, and we know this because the level of delinquencies is rising quite dramatically, much faster than the level of foreclosures, even though they had 3.5 million foreclosures, up from 2.5 million last year. The level of delinquencies, people not paying their mortgages, is rising even more rapidly. And therefore, in 2010, the banks will have to disclose that the rate of delinquencies and foreclosures is a lot higher, and in fact, their balance sheets are going to have to be slammed once again with more write-offs to account for these foreclosures and delinquencies. Now, they could, if they were honest, tell the folks down there at the SEC or the NASDAQ or any one of the regulatory oversight agencies that, in fact, they've got huge losses right now that they need to disclose, and that this would be paired against any gains that were given to them vis-a-vis the taxpayer after Paulson put a gun to Congress's head and extorted $700 billion, $13 trillion. But they don't, because that would interrupt the bonus payments. So as soon as the bonus payments are paid out and they're safely invested in gold bullion and silver bullion and taken offshore somewhere, then Q1 2010, Morgan and Sachs are going to come out and say, oh my God, it's a shock. The rate of foreclosures is a lot higher than we anticipated. Our balance sheet is impaired. We need another bailout. And they're going to go right back down there to Washington and demand another $10 trillion. So that's something to look forward to in 2010. The good news, if you own gold and silver, is that all that bonus money, you know, a lot of that bonus money is going to go into gold and silver, because nobody knows better than the folks on Wall Street how corrupt the system is. And they know that systemic collapse is very soon coming, and the gold and silver is the only way to protect their wealth. So those prices, you know, we were talking about something earlier, Stacey. I want to get into it again. At what point do you think there's going to be a buying panic in gold? Because we know from history that prices, as they go up, they attract more buyers during a mania. This is an effect that Peter Lynch talked about in his some of his work that he put out in the 1980s. Peter Lynch, very famous mutual fund manager of Fidelity Magellan Fund 20 years ago, he talked about how when prices go up, people get more excited at the higher price and buy more. It's different than when people go shopping at Walmart and they look for the lowest price. On Wall Street, people look for the highest price. But anyway.
Well, I think people also like round numbers, and especially the media, because, you know, the buying panic isn't going to start at 2,200 or 1,700, because it doesn't make as great and fantastic a headline. It'll be like $2,000. Gold hits 2,000. And then the media will start profiling people like yourself. They'll come to you and say, Max, you bought gold at $400. Now it's at 2,000. What do you think? And then everybody will say, wow, this guy bought some, honey, I read about this guy who bought some gold at 400 and now it's 2,000. We should try to make some triple or quadruple or quintuple our money like that too. Let's buy some gold.
Exactly. This is what drives markets. It's not greed. It's envy. People, the utility value of money is such that you don't need much money in the bank for you to forget about the pursuit of having more money. The number is actually shockingly low. There was a study done a couple of years ago that found that 90% of people who had $20,000 in the bank started to, or should say, they stopped obsessing about money because it just became something they didn't think about.
It was a $20,000 a year income, I believe.
So here you have what drives the prices really are envy. And as you described it, you think that your neighbor's getting rich and you're not getting rich. So you take ridiculous risks to try to catch up with your neighbor. So yeah, here you get the price of gold, $2,000 an ounce. I mean, I think that clearly is going to be a number to trigger a buying panic. And you will see then the Joe Bag of Donuts out there taking his last $2,000 that he, you know, won in a Saturday night poker game after having lost his house, his wife, his kids, his car, and his job. And he'll buy an ounce of gold. And on the margin, that'll have the effect of driving the price up dramatically. And we'll see that $4,000 to $5,000 an ounce telescoped quite quickly as the mass panic buying public comes in at $2,000.
You know, speaking of Peter Lynch, there was another quote similar to this price rising and stuff is Warren Buffett was quoted as these house prices, I think, was crashing. He said, I don't understand why people always get so upset when prices go down. Because he said, I get the opposite. It excites me because I think, wow, this is a good, you know, it's a good time to buy the same thing for less.
Right. Well, he's the most successful investor in the world, and because he has triumphed against the instinct of greed and envy, yeah. And he has stuck to his mantra of value investing. Now, there's another old saying on Wall Street is, you got to feed the ducks when they're quacking.
What does that mean?
Well, for example, during a buying panic, when the ducks are going to be buying gold at $4,000 or $5,000 an ounce, you're going to hear a lot of noise, a mm-hmm. lot of quacking. Quack, quack, quack. We want more gold. And then guys like me will be selling. But you got to wait for them to start quacking. You got to wait for the gaggle of geese and the ducks to start really making a lot of noise because it's too much work to try to get them to buy stuff when they're not quacking. You know, they only buy stuff when it's the absolute worst time for them to buy stuff. So we gotta wait for that to be the case. You gotta wait for them to kind of settle into a dementia of panic buying before you feed them what they think they want at $4,000 to $5,000 an ounce. So, but I think the 2,000 an ounce price, when it is triggered, will bring in a stampede of panic buying. I think that's and you know, for this region, Australia, New Zealand. And over there in Canada, this is an important concept because they're the countries that have resources and they are benefiting from this collapse of the fiat currency fractional reserve banking model. As countries like China and Russia announce that they want to get out of trading oil in dollars, they want to start trading oil in currencies other than dollars, probably a basket of currencies, which will be backed in to some degree by gold bullion. And this is another nail in the dollar's coffin and another big plus for the price of gold bullion.
Well, that's right. But you talk about the monetary system collapsing, and part of that is with the financial systems collapsing. Now, you would think with the whole disaster that has happened in the last year that there would be, more regulation on banks, more... you know, the SEC would be investigating some more of this, the crimes committed.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see, since we last did our show for RDU, did you see that the SEC has appointed a new chief operating officer? And that is a 29-year-old Goldman Sachs guy.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, that's like here in France, Nicolas Sarkozy put his son in charge of a huge district in the north, La Défense.
Not even, it's the business, he's to head business, like trading, finance for France.
Right, it's nepotism. Goldman is the king, and they put the prince in these various roles. It's not, it's gone beyond any kind of tangential connection to a democracy or republic. This is a monarchy, monarchs and monopolists. There is no representational government at all in the United States. It's finished. It died in the year 2000. 1776 to 2000. That's America. Rest in peace. Thank you very much. Now we're in a post-America world of an American monarchy that has Goldman and J.P. Morgan as kings that are divvying up the wealth of the what's left. and in encouraging the growth of this enormous peasant class.
Well, with that, we'll be right back after this music break, honey. So you were talking about the emergence of a new peasant class, and it's really a financial oligarchy because it's across the globe, really, whether it's, Tony Blair running J.P. Morgan or has some job at J.P. Morgan in the U.K., making $2 million a year. Nicolas Sarkozy appointing his 23-year-old son to head up La Défense. This 29-year-old guy from Goldman Sachs, who, by the way, ZeroHedge.com pointed out that he's never traded. He wasn't a trader for Goldman Sachs. So here's a guy who is supposed to be overlooking trading anomalies and sort of trading crimes.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't actually have the experience in that.
No, well, that would be a liability if you're trying to game the system and manipulate the market, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So, but there's no sort of William K. Black, who was the regulator responsible for basically charging those 1,800 savings and loans executives who did time, 1,800 of them. And he managed to change the system despite all the political pressure. He said there were no politicians, nobody in Congress wanted to help him. But he went after all these very well-connected, powerful savings and loans guys. But he was interviewed this past week on Democracy Now! And he was saying, you know, it's really up to the people. He said there seems to be very little pressure. Nobody seems to care that there's nothing being done about the bankers. Or the banksters, as many call them.
Well, look, if you are part of the aristocracy on Wall Street and you are creating fiat currency at will in a fractional reserve banking system, you have the ability to declare by fiat that dog poop is $1 billion. So you can pick up dog poop from the street and you can say, based on my fractional reserve fiat currency model and algorithm trading, this dog poop is worth $1 billion. And I can prove it because I'm going to sell it to Citigroup and they're going to give me $1 billion of their fiat currency fractional reserve monetary unit in exchange. And for that, I'm going to get a fee. And I'm going to do this every day, thousands of times a day. And at the end of the year, I'm going to pay myself billions and billions in fees. Now, the problem is that the average American looks at their front yard and they see lots and lots of dog poop and they think they're billionaires. But what they don't understand is that they don't work for Goldman Sachs. Once they figure that out and they say, you know what, I don't work for Goldman Sachs and that dog poop is actually just dog poop, then you might see a revolt. But until then, they live in a delusionary world where their own dog poop is worth as much as Goldman Sachs dog poop, and that's not true.
Well, that's one way to put it, Max.
Yeah, I thought that was a very elegant way to describe the injustice in the American financial system, that Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan can define what is money at any given moment of any given day because they control a fiat currency fractional reserve system with no accountability and no collateral in the form of something solid like gold or silver. So they can literally point to anything and say, like for every week you read about that they're going to turn something else into tradable commodity. Oh, you just told me this morning that, or I read somewhere they're going to...
Divorce.
Yeah, they're going to... they're going to turn divorce settlements into contracts?
Well, more and more of these high-profile, high-net-worth divorces are being financed by hedge funds who are... betting on these divorces, basically.
Okay, so the hedge fund can make millions and millions of dollars trading divorce contracts, effectively, on the shadow banking system in the fractional reserve fiat currency system. But most people say, wow, I'm going to get divorced, therefore I must be also a very wealthy person.
Mm-hmm. But it also leads to further, just like most people in the bottom 99% assume that financial chaos and catastrophe and a collapsed economy is is something that bankers don't want, because why would they want that? Because they'll lose money themselves. But very few people fail to understand that they actually make more money with instability. So if you see hedge funds getting into the divorce business, if they're starting to profit from instability in marriage and relationships, who knows what they'll do? Who knows?
Well, of course, I mean, if I were a hedge fund and I started trying divorce contracts as a hedge or as an adjunct to my business, I would buy a website like TMZ, which is a Hollywood gossip site.
Yeah.
And I would make sure that gossip got out there pertaining to very high-profile divorces. Let's say Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it behooves me as a hedge fund manager who's trading divorce contracts to try to get those two to divorce. So I would buy a site like TMZ, which, again, is another institution in America, the press that's been compromised by money and is no longer exists as a function of a working society. It's merely the tool of the moneyed hedge fund, fractional reserve, fiat currency elite to twist and turn to their benefit. And I would put out these rumors.
Thanks to Australia. Thanks, Australia, for sending us Murdoch.
Well, yeah, you know, the tabloid press and the lack of any kind of standards has unfortunately taken over. And even a newspaper like the New York Times, sadly, has basically come under the spell of the hedge fund community and does their bidding.
Yeah, but it's like you said, it's like the ducks quacking. The New York Times, you know, like the population has been dumbed down and the ducks are quacking for more information about Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt. So they have to give it to them because the ducks aren't quacking for information about financial crimes.
Yeah, so here you got these divorce contracts. Here you got the hedge funds who would then feed into, so and to get to your point about volatility and about chaos, and that it is profitable. That's why you have things like the VIX, the volatility index. You know, volatility itself trades as a commodity, as an index on various exchanges. So you can buy and sell chaos and volatility. And again, if you own the volatility contract, it makes sense to drop a bomb on Pakistan and to say send a drone over a wedding in Pakistan and kill some people. You own the volatility index. It's in your interest to do so. If you're selling the volatility index, then you send Hillary Clinton over to some country to have a peace talk, because then the volatility dries up and you're making money on the price decline of the volatility index because you're short the volatility index. If you're long the volatility index, then yeah, send some drones. But that's who's driving all the foreign and economic policy, are the fund managers and their proxies in government who own contracts tied to these events. Now, I'll say again, I feel a little bit guilty about this, having invented this concept with the virtual specialist technology back in 1995, which is used by Hollywood Stock Exchange and now Cantor Exchange to trade box office futures and events as part of what we call the prediction market industry. But my intention was not to do this. I thought that there was going to be another avenue taken. I'm sorry to say that, like Robert Oppenheimer, who invented the, basically worked on the nuclear bomb. Nuclear bomb!
Nuclear
bombs! You know, he regretted it in the end, didn't he? I regret the virtual specialist technology, but
well,
I have no control over it.
Speaking of volatility and buying and selling contracts and then creating events, another story on ZeroHedge.com, and they're really quite good at it really tracking volume and options and stuff like that, that it's hard to find information like that for most normal Joe Bag of Donuts. So, or for Stacey Herbert.
No.
So they were talking about some pretty large volume on options that expire within 30 days of $100 oil.
Mm-hmm.
So who is gambling that, like, significant amounts of money on oil being at $100, you know, 25%, 30% more from here?
Yeah.
Within the next 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to, you can think about that, ponder that question during this music break. And we'll come back from this music break and Max will have something brilliant to say about this.
Okay.
So Max, I asked before the break, why would somebody be buying these options that expire in 30 days, within 30 days, for $100 oil? Now Max used to be an options trader, one of the biggest options trader in America at one point.
Well, in the Shearson and Lehman system, certainly,
Okay.
back in the 1989.
Yeah, and you had cornered the market and Philip Morris had, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
So you
Which
had nobody.
that was an interesting
That was a
experience.
big mistake. But is somebody here making a big mistake, like your situation with Philip Morris, or is
Thanks for bringing that up.
or is some does somebody have inside information about maybe a pending attack on, say, somewhere like Iran, which might drive the price of oil up so high? What do you think it is?
Well, it could be one of two things. First of all, it reminds me going back a little bit. Remember there was a huge S&P put option trade that was done a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I believe that the conclusion was that this was part of what's called a box trade. You can look that up on Google. And that for purposes of hedging, there was this enormous S&P put contract that was put on, and it was part of the very significant and large hedging strategy, and which was came under the rubric of or the nomenclature of box trade. You know, we'll look at that again. So either this is part of a similar type of situation, or B, there's like the airline puts on American Airlines and United before the 9/11 attacks,
Or the puts on Bear Stearns.
before the controlled demolition of Bear Stearns,
Uh-huh.
there's some insider information, and we're going to see some event in the near future, very near future, that's going to drive the price of oil up $20, and you're going to see somebody cash out for huge profits.
Maybe you know what? Thinking back of that giant put option on the S&P 500.
Yes.
That took place, remember, it was 2007, and somebody made a giant bet. It was like $1 billion if you just looked at it on its own, that the market would crash by something like 40, 50% by the end of September 2007. Maybe it was some doofus who misread the insider on the plans for the controlled demolition of the US economy. Maybe he was 1 year early.
Yeah, it could have been early, and could have taken an enormous loss. And of course, the tragedy is that those losses are not disclosed. They're held in unnumbered accounts until such time as it's convenient to disclose them, which could have come a year later after Paulson held Congress hostage for $700 billion. And then, in all the chaos and in the shuffle, that loss could have been magically just kind of matched with a artificial gain or a tax bailout and magically made to disappear, having never had an account number ever in its existence, and therefore, you know, having never existed to begin with. I
No,
mean,
in
this is.
fact, I have another theory about what it was. Who placed that bet? It was a guy who ran Lehman Brothers. I forget his name now. He's disappeared from the face of the
Dick
earth.
Fuld.
Dick Fuld, but he was an arch enemy of Hank Paulson. So
Yeah.
maybe Hank Paulson was planning on pulling the plug on the US economy in 2007, September. But because he found out it was Dick Fuld who was trying to front run the collapse,
Right.
maybe he held it together for another year until he could crash the following year.
Well, this brings up another point in terms of World War III being fought in the financial markets and not on the ground. Because you hear often people say, well, why would China dump the dollar? Because they have so many dollars, it's just going to debase the value of their dollars. You know, that's like saying, why would one country blow up the factory of another country if, in fact, they were the owners of that factory? It's the war. War is the rules of war are different.
Yeah,
You know,
exactly.
and China is at war with America. China and Russia and Iran are basically, with the Shanghai Cooperative Organization agreement, they're at war with America.
I think the US is at war with China. If you remember from the Policy for a New American Century, written by Dick Cheney and Jeb Bush and what, Donald Rumsfeld or Paul Wolfowitz, all those sort of guys. They, all of their policies about Iraq and invading Afghanistan, all the plots to do that, were about China, about containing China. It had nothing to do so much with like grabbing Iraqi oil for themselves. It was about keeping China from getting Iraqi oil.
Mm-hmm. So here you have a war. The war has started already. I mean, this is one of those things that people are going to look back in 50 years and figure out that, you know what, the war started already by 2009, the end of 2009. The war has already begun. And in war, the rules are different. And in the fog of war, different things happen. So China is not thinking the same way that they would be thinking in peacetime. They're on the war footing.
See, yeah, you're right. All's fair in love and war. We were talking about the hedge funds getting into the love business, mm-hmm. the divorce.
Right.
And now we're talking about the war business.
And then they're in the war business as well. And they've got, you know, bets placed in all of these various outcomes and that are highly leveraged bets. And any time that any of their highly leveraged bets go bust, they get more bailout money from the government. So it's heads they win, tails we lose. The top 1% can never lose. They live in an inflationary world where the price of gold is going to go higher and higher. And the bottom 99% live in a deflationary world where wages and jobs and quality of life are cascading down into the mud. But as long as they've got a front yard full of dog poop that they think is worth billions of dollars because they're going to hope to sell it to Goldman Sachs someday, they're happy.
Well, at least you here in New Zealand are quite safe. Even like, remember we were watching that History Channel thing, almost like no mammals were able to even get here. It's like way out deserted in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and giant waves all around and sharks circling the country.
Very exotic flora and fauna.
That's
very
right.
Very few mammals.
No, but they have wild birds, as we've discussed before.
Yes, wild birds.
But you have good farmland, good sheep.
Yummy, you know, yummy
they can
sheep.
Keep you company.
That's
good.
What?
Oh, wait. I was thinking we were doing our British show.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Well, we only have 30 seconds left. So again, it's time for Max's long departure, his long farewell. What are you going to say?
Am I going to, like, kill myself?
No, you're going to say goodbye to the people of Christchurch.
Oh, in Christchurch, yes. Well, we must say goodbye now. Until next week, bye, y'all.